We are in Lamentations 3 today as we continue to work our way through that book in this kind of practical how to study section of the how to study class. So I guess we'll start the way we've kind of been starting. This one is a little bit interesting, at least in the way I was looking at it, because I think it breaks down a little bit more differently. There are more options of how to break the book or the chapter down. And I guess before I say anything else about that, I'll ask how you saw this chapter is kind of unfolding. If there was anything in particular that struck you as the way this chapter is put together, and then we'll kind of look at other ways of that as well. Anything stand out to anybody? Hope? Yeah, that's kind of one of the surprising features of this chapter, perhaps, is one way of putting it. There hasn't been a whole lot of hope going on in the Book of Lamentations. For it to suddenly show up was a little surprising. Okay. Yeah, so we've been talking about this kind of acrostic nature of the Book of Lamentations, that the first four chapters at least, each verse in chapters 1, 2, and 4 starts with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And typically what we've seen in the other chapters 1 and 2, is that each verse has three pairs of lines, three couplets. And each one of those three starts with that next letter of the alphabet. Lamentations chapter 3, as Brian mentioned, is basically the same length as the first two chapters. It's still three couplets, but each one of those starts with the same letter. So if we're doing it in English, verses 1, 2, and 3 would each start with A, verses 4, 5, and 6 would each start with B, verses 7, 8, and 9 would each start with C, and I better stop counting or I'm going to get lost. 10's about as high as I can get these days. So it's different all of a sudden. So each letter gets three verses instead of just one verse. So there's something that is emphasized about Lamentations chapter 3 by the nature of that, at least seems to be the case. And so for this section on hope to show up in the middle of that is maybe a significant thing. Also, the fact that it's the center of the book. You know, we've talked about that before. The way Hebrew thinking was, is they very often emphasized the center point. That's the way they would outline and organize things. So whereas, your modern outline these days, you'd have your Roman numeral 1 and A, B, and C, and 1, 2, and 3, and so forth and so on from that. The way that the Hebrew mind thought very often was more along the lines of A, B, C, B, A. And this middle point would be the emphatic point. And that's what's going on in Lamentations as well. It's a five-chapter book. The chapter that is most emphatic in the acrostic itself, each letter gets three verses, is also the center point. It's also the one point kind of in the middle of that where there's this emphasis on hope and the goodness of God. And so all of that seems to kind of funnel you to the idea that the real heart of the Book of Lamentations is the middle of this chapter, which is this sudden positive turn, which again is kind of unexpected. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on. Anyone find any, in your own studies, find any basic idea of how you think this chapter breaks down organizationally? Is there any organization to this chapter, do you think? Okay. Yeah, and you get a fair amount of that in poetry in general. People will say the same thing in different ways kind of repeatedly, especially in Old Testament poetry, where one of the key features is this idea of parallelism, where they'll say the same thing in different kinds of words. And it's more than just repeating themselves, but you do kind of have that repetitive kind of perspective. Anything else? Okay.
It does seem to end in a prayer, like the first two chapters.
Mm-hmm.
I saw, kind of in verses, starting in verse 25, there's basically an exhortation.
Okay.
And then starting in verse 40, it's basically a call to prayer and then a prayer through the end of the chapter.
Okay. So you'd say 1 through 24 is kind of one section, 25 through 39 is this exhortation, teaching sort of section, and then 40 through 66 is the prayer. Something else that kind of goes along with this basic structure, and one of the things that you'll find if you do any reading in secondary literature, in commentaries and stuff about Lamentations, is that very often they'll stop the first section at verse 18, or maybe verse 21, but typically verse 18. And one of the reasons why is that, thematically speaking, in terms of what's going on, verses 1 through 18 are all this kind of negative sort of, things are not good in verses 1 through 18, and then picking up in verse 19, and particularly in verses 22 through 24, you suddenly have this very positive sort of perspective. So there's something of a natural break there, and I would say that obviously there is a natural break there, but I would put that more of a 1 through 19, 1 through 19, is that right? 1 through 18, is that what I'm trying to say? 1 through 18, and then 19 through 24. As subsections. And one of the reasons why I would say it's helpful to divide it this way is because what we're seeing in Lamentations 3 is what we saw more clearly in Lamentations 1, and that is a shift from the way the speaker is speaking about what's going on. And so that's a very clear statement, isn't it? A shift in the way the speaker is speaking about what's going on. Brilliant stuff. What I'm trying to say is he talks in first person in the first section, he talks in third person in the second section, he talks in first person again in this last section. And so you have this very clear shift in the way that he's talking. And that kind of helps divide out the section. And what makes that significant is the fact that 19 through 24 is part of this section. I mean, if 19 through 24 was just kind of its own thing out there somewhere, that'd be a nice feel-good kind of statement about God and the nature of things. But the fact that 19 through 24 is in the book of Lamentations at all, and the fact that it is part of this incredibly depressing sort of section of 1 through 24, largely is not a positive section, really speaks to the significance of those verses. And so it talks in this first section, for example, about the rod of God's wrath. Actually, it says the rod of His wrath. And that, I think, is a significant point as well. Because it emphasizes the fact that although these are individual poems, each chapter of Lamentations is its own unit of thought. It is its own acrostic poem. It also makes it pretty clear that they're not to be read in isolation from one another. Who is the hymn in verse 1? The rod of His wrath. Who is Him? Well, I gave you the answer a second ago, and I'm pretty sure we're all on the same page, right? It's the rod of God's wrath. Well, why do you think it's the rod of God's wrath? Well, if you look one verse before that, in chapter 2 and verse 22, you summoned, as to a festival day, my terrors on every side, and on the day of the anger of the Lord, no one escaped or survived, those whom I held and raised, my enemy destroyed. I am the man who has seen affliction under the rod of His wrath. Well, the immediate preceding verse in the larger book speaks of the anger of the Lord, and so when you get to the next verse, although it is in its own unique poem, when it starts talking about His wrath, you immediately make that connection. And so there are individual units of thought, but they were composed in such a way that they are to be read together as part of a whole. It's not like the book of Psalms, where you have individual psalms that were kind of collected at some point, and we don't know the exact nature of how all the psalms were collected and put together, but we know that the earliest one, at least the earliest one we can date, was written by Moses, and we know that some were written at least in the exile, in Babylonian captivity, if not later. And so there's a pretty wide range of dates in which the Psalms were written. They were compiled by somebody at some point under the guidance of the inspiration, I presume. We know that the Psalms are inspired. I presume that the process of putting those correct Psalms together was as well, but you know, we're not told that specifically. But whoever did it, there's not necessarily a connection between, say, Psalm 22 and Psalm 23, although there might be, you know. Maybe you can find one, but it's not necessarily. They're individual Psalms. That's not how Lamentations is. It's individual poems, but it's meant to be read together, and you get that hint there as well. And so this is all, you know, the rod of God's wrath, driven and brought me into darkness without any light. He's turned against me his hand. And that first verse is kind of something of a theme, you know, maybe a complaint. The first three verses, I should say, is the basic complaint. And then verses 4 through 18 is kind of the proof of the complaint. How is it that someone can say that they're under the rod of God's wrath, that he's driven them into darkness and he's turned his hand against them? Well, look at verses 4 through 18 and you'll see the evidence of that is basically the idea. All of the negative things that have happened. And again, he's not accusing God of doing something evil to him. If you put this back into the context of chapter 2, it's very clear, excuse me, that he's well aware of his sin, that God is judging him appropriately for what he has done, for the nation, that is. And so it's not just complaining against God, but at the same time, it's talking about how bad things are for him. And then again, it's in that context. We're picking up in verse 19, he says, "Remember my affliction and my wanderings, the wormwood and the gall. My soul continually remembers it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him." And then he goes on to talk about the goodness of God after that point. But, you know, this is where we get that hymn that we sing sometimes, "Great is thy faithfulness." And if you weren't aware of the fact that that came from Lamentations, or even if you were aware of it and maybe never studied Lamentations before, as we are now to see just how depressing that is, it might be a shocking thing to suddenly realize, you know, this song that's about the great faithfulness of God and the fact that his mercies are new every morning. There has not been anything in the book of Lamentations up to this point to prepare us for this statement, really. I mean, there's been a few prayers, but really nothing that we have seen up to this point. I mean, look at verses 16 through 18, what immediately comes before it. He's made my teeth grind on gravel and made me cower in ashes. My soul is bereft of peace. I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say my endurance has perished. So has my hope from the Lord. And then just like that, things change. And really, what leads to it is verse 21. "This I call to mind and therefore I have hope." His hope is based in this, and the this, I think, is what follows. And that is the very essence of the nature of God, and it has to do with this steadfast love of the Lord that never ceases. And the word that's translated steadfast love, or if you've read from another translation, mercy perhaps there, is this word we've talked about before. It's a Hebrew word that's used some 250 times in the Old Testament. But it's translated by steadfast love or mercy or loving kindness or kind of the three main ways it's translated. There is not a single English word that even remotely comes close to exhausting the meaning of that word. It's just one of those words that we don't have a good English equivalent to kind of cover the bases of all of it. It does refer to God's loving kindness. It does refer to God's mercy. It does refer to God's steadfast love. But it's so much more than that. If you look through the Old Testament, if you were to do a word study on this word and find everywhere that it's used and look at the context and what it's suggesting in that context, and other words around it, that kind of, you know, the companion words that go with it, so to speak, this word has to do with grace and love and compassion and truth and faithfulness and goodness and forgiveness and deliverance and God's covenant faithfulness. It's a word that's often used in the context of the covenant that God has made with His people and Him being loyal to that covenant in spite of the people and how they're acting. All of that is in this word. And so when the, I almost said the psalmist, the lamentationist, the lamenter, says, you know, I called this to mind and then I had hope. The steadfast love, the covenant fidelity, the mercy, the loving kindness of the Lord is never ending. It never ceases. It never comes to an end. His mercies are limitless. That's the idea of them being new every morning. You know, as many days as there could possibly be, each day brings with it new mercy from God, and new forgiveness from God, and new faithfulness from God, and new covenant loyalty from God. If you understand that perspective of who God is, then there will invariably be hope. Because however bad things may be now, however sinful we may be now, there is not a morning where you wake up and God won't forgive you and God won't give you another chance. There's not a morning where you wake up and everything is hopeless and there's no possibility of things ever progressing to a different state of being. And that, I think, is one of the most profound practical kinds of lessons out of this chapter. Usually I try to save that toward the end of this kind of studying the text this way. But I mean, you look at this statement, particularly in verses 22 through 24, this is about the most hopeless time in the history of the nation of Israel. Things don't ever get any worse for the people than when they are in captivity. They've just been besieged. They've just watched mothers eating their children and other children dying in the streets. I mean, this is as bad as it gets. It's in that context, against that backdrop, that he makes this statement. They don't sing "Great is Thy Faithfulness" after they cross the Red Sea. I mean, they sing a great song there, obviously, but this statement is not made in the context of something grand like the crossing of the Red Sea, but against the worst time in the history of the people. Nothing looked possible. Nothing looked hopeful. Nothing looked worthwhile. Nothing looked comforting at all in the situation that they were in. And yet the sufferer looks at the nature of God and makes this great declaration of praise. And then practically speaking, I mean, if a man of God in the midst of the suffering that these people went through and everything that he'd seen with his eyes that you can read about in the book of Lamentations, you can read about it in Jeremiah and 2 Kings, of how bad things were. If in the midst of all of that, he can say, I know who God is, therefore there's hope, great is His faithfulness. If he can say that, who among us cannot? Regardless of how bad things get, regardless of the circumstances we may find ourselves in, regardless of the situation that we may be in because of our own sin, which person among us cannot sing along with him about the great faithfulness of God if this person in this context can say it? And I don't know that there is a more profound practical lesson in the entire book of Lamentations than that. I think that's as significant as it gets. Shane?
Here, and you think about the reason for their suffering, I mean, you could almost say the suffering is self-inflicted. I mean, obviously God inflicted this punishment upon them. He doesn't sin of disobedience. But God is faithful from the standpoint that He said, this is what I will do if you are faithful, this is what I will do if you are unfaithful. And God is, they can have so much trust in God because God is faithful to both. When they sinned, He did what He said He was going to do. Punish them in the way that He said He was going to punish them. And He'll also reward them if they will turn and live the way right. They're supposed to. So I think it's interesting to look at the faithfulness of God, both standpoints, that He's faithful not only in blessing them and being there for them, but He's also faithful in punishing them.
That's a good point, and that's something look around the world, you don't have to look that far, I'm sure, and the kids that you see that are the most troubled children or cause the most trouble are the ones whose parents never do what they say they're going to do in regard to punishing their child. You've seen that before, I'm sure, at the grocery store. I've You know, if you do this, then I'm going to, but they never do. It's because they can't trust their parents to do what they say they're going to do in regard to punishing them. The children that are disciplined consistently and their parents do what they say they're going to do in regard to disciplining them, I mean, those are the ones that have confidence in their parents and ultimately have more respect and love for their parents and are far better citizens. Barry?
Because the flip side of that is what we usually don't pay attention to. We usually focus on, if we don't do what God says, God will punish as God has said he will punish. And we stop there. We don't realize that if we turn and do what's right, he is faithful to forgive and to continue to love and be kind and all of those other things. We, for some reason, we always want to stop at punishment, but we never want to go beyond and say, but he's full of kindness as well. There is hope. There's always hope. And we always forget that.
Yeah, and that's one of those things I think that comes from historical context. And that's I don't want to go too far down this road, but you know, we have this tendency to disassociate ourselves with various religious movements, and you know, we're the Lord's church. We trace back to Acts chapter 2, and that's obviously the goal. That's what we want to be a part of. But we need to understand who we are in something of a historical context, because you know, the more we are influenced by, in our thinking, by, you know, Alexander Campbell and those guys that followed him, by Martin Luther and those guys that followed them, and so forth. I mean, what you start to see is very often there's a lot of reactionary thinking. You know, why did Martin Luther do what he did and teach what he taught and react the way he reacted? Well, he did because he was in this historical context of the abuses of Catholicism, and I think he wouldn't come out and say his goal was to get as far away from Catholicism as he could, but there was definitely that swing of the pendulum that he went, I believe, too far in certain directions because he was reacting to Calvinism. And then, or not to Calvinism, to Catholicism. And then what happens with us very often, and you know, I think starting back with Campbell and people that thought like him, is they said, well, that's not right. We need to get away from that. And it's really easy to swing the pendulum to the other side. And you've got all these denominational people in the world talking about God's love and goodness and mercy and how, you know, you can just do whatever you want and God's going to let you go to heaven. And that's just not right. And so we swing it to the other side and talk about God's judgment and, you know, justice and righteousness and punishment and eternal fire and those things. But it's easy for us to focus so much on that that we miss the other side. And what we need to be aware of, and that's why the kind of historical context that I'm talking about is helpful, is to see, why do we believe what we believe in the way we believe it? Where did this kind of start? Is it this kind of reaction? And if it is that kind of reaction, we need to make sure we don't swing the pendulum too far. We need to try to find the middle ground. We need to find the truth, because as soon as that pendulum starts swinging back and forth, what's going to happen is, if you're on one side or the other, you're probably not where the truth is, or you're overemphasizing one aspect of the truth to the neglect of the other. And that's why, you know, coming up in the fall when Jeremy's going to be doing this class talking about church history, I think it'll be helpful to see kind of how some of that stuff played itself out and give us a little bit more of that kind of context. And so, yeah, I would say, you know, if all you ever talk about is the grace of God and never talk about the justice of God and the wrath of God, and we've seen plenty of that in Lamentations, you're missing the boat. But if all you talk about is the wrath of God and the judgment of God but never talk about the grace of God, you're missing the boat. They are two sides of the same coin. And they must be understood in that kind of context. Thanks, both of you, for those comments. Well, also in this middle section is this focus on the goodness of the Lord. It's kind of this exhortation section. The Lord is good to those who wait for Him, the soul who seeks Him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. The idea being that if you bear it in your youth, you'll kind of walk the straight and narrow later is the sort of idea. There's exhortations about how they are to endure the punishment that they're in now. And notice that kind of the progression in verses 28 through 30 of how this kind of works itself out. Let him sit alone in silence when it is laid on him. That's not an easy thing to do. You know, you're bearing some kind of punishment because of something that you've done. It's not easy for, you know, the Israelites in captivity to sit in silence and wait for the Lord patiently and silently. But as difficult as that may be, it's easier than what comes next, which is let him put his mouth in the dust. There may yet be hope. The idea of putting your mouth in the dust is bowing down before somebody, not in a worshipful pose, but a sign of submission that you're basically laying down before them, fully submitting to this other person. And that's you know, as soon as you get that kind of command to fully submit yourself to your enemy, suddenly sitting alone in silence doesn't sound quite so bad. This whole lot harder. But then you get to the next verse, which is, let him give his cheek to the one who strikes, and let him be filled with insult, which is even the hardest yet. You know, I'd rather bow down before them and show submission than to completely surrender myself to letting them beat me and insult me. But that's the way that it is going to be right now, which is you're waiting for the Lord. You're waiting for the Lord's salvation. You trust in the Lord and His promises. He has said that He will restore His people, and He's going to. So what you need to do now is bear with the suffering that you're enduring, because you know then that you have hope, the reason for hope, verses 31 through 33, for the Lord will not cast off forever. This grief is going to end. Though he cause grief, he will have compassion. Excuse me, compassion according to the abundance of his steadfast love, and so that his compassion will ultimately outweigh the sorrow that he causes. And then verse 33: he does not afflict from the heart or grieve the children of men. Evil will not have free reign, because ultimately God doesn't approve of that. Verse 36, and then beyond that, God is in control. Verses 37 through 39, and so the evil is going to end. And so you have this kind of marvelous section of the goodness of God. After that great statement of the faithfulness of God, you get a hint of the end of the judgment coming, and what they need to do in the meantime is wait on the Lord patiently for His salvation. Yeah, that's something that I wasn't planning on emphasizing too terribly much, but there are definitely kind of those sorts of hints of that. Notice verse 46 as well. All our enemies open their mouths against us. That sounds a little bit like Psalm 22, for example. And there are a few of those other verses of Lamentations 3 and Psalm 22 that kind of have an echo, and obviously that points forward to the Messiah. So, all right, anything else? Yes, Jay.
Early in the chapter, kind of made a correlation with Job.
Yeah. Yeah, and even that's a really good point. It sounds like Job. Verse 4, made my flesh and my skin waste away. He's broken my bones. And even down verse 12 is another one. He bent his bow and set me as a target for his arrow. A couple times in the book of Job, he talks about how it seems like God is taking target practice with him. Job 7 and Job 16 both talk about that. Even the great declaration of faith, you know, I know that my Redeemer lives, is Job's. That shows up in there as well. But what I was going to get to is the idea of sitting alone in silence. That's the very first thing that Job's friends do when they show up on scene to comfort Job, is they sit there with Job without saying anything for a week. And that's probably the best thing they do in the entire book. It's when they start talking that all the trouble starts. The best thing they do is sit there and keep their mouths shut. And sometimes, you know, maybe there's a good lesson in comforting the bereaved in that context, that sometimes the best thing to do is just go and be with them and not try to rationalize what's going on. Where did I see a hand? Brother Winton, you were going to say something. Yes. Yes. Yes, that's a great get us moving in the right direction again. And this is one of those places, what I was ultimately kind of talking about, I guess I can write a little bit below that and you can still see it. It's a couple ways of breaking down this section, and I don't know if anyone in your own outlining of chapter, anyone have any kind of subdivisions of 40 through 66? What's that? Maybe at 48. What would be your breakdown for that? Okay, so you could say 40 through 47 is first singular, and 48 through 66 is not second singular, I was right, it's first plural, except it's the other way around, and 40 through 47 is first plural, and 48 through 66 is first singular. So that's one way of looking at it, and it kind of matches, you know, what we've seen already in the larger division of the chapter. There is that way of dividing it up, and that's kind of the first way I marked it as well because of that shift. And there's no reason why you can't have a change in the middle of a section, a section of three verses. Obviously, that's not necessarily the most natural, but it's a possibility. Any other thoughts on it? Anyone have a different way of breaking it down? Yeah, Jeremy?
Yeah, I tried to stay with the strophe and divided it up 40 to 51 as a communal lament, seeking repentance. And my justification for that was even when he switches to the first person singular in 48 through 51, it seems like he's still mourning the community as a whole, and then in 52 it turns to a personal lament.
Okay.
Eventually implication there at the end.
Okay.
So it's almost like he's kind of using his own personal lament, his own story as kind of an example of what the community as a whole is suffering.
All right. Shane? That is a good question, and it goes to something that we probably should have started talking about, 25 minutes ago or so. And that is verse 1. How about that? A good place to start. The very first thing that he says is, I am the man who has seen affliction. Who is that? Who is the man who has seen affliction? Jeremiah. Any other options? All the people? But it's singular, so. Okay. Okay. So you've got a couple of basic options in looking at that verse, and it kind of goes back to, you remember in chapter 1 we encountered Zion personified, and Zion is the woman who is speaking about all of her troubles. Well, this figure may be that same kind of thing, and so you could have it being the author speaking about himself or speaking about the people, or you can have it as this same kind of personified figure of all of the nation. And so, you know, you'd call it the afflicted man, the afflicted person, who is not an individual, but is everybody. It is the community of the people. And it, you know, in the final analysis, I think you're basically getting to the same thing. I mean, yes, Jeremiah, presuming the author is Jeremiah, has seen some pretty severe individual personal affliction, but it's also pretty clear that he's not just talking about his own trouble that he's seen. And so, you know, I don't think it's just Jeremiah talking about himself. Maybe you can say Jeremiah talking about himself and the people as a whole. But if, you know, it's this personified, afflicted man who is talking about the affliction of the people, you're basically on the same thing. So what's, I think, is significant to understand, however you want to try to figure out that phrase, is that what's by and large being talked about in Lamentations 3 is the affliction the people endured through this context. So where he talks about I, you know, first person singular, whether it's down here or up there in the first section, he's not just talking about himself. He's not just saying, this happened to me individually, but he's talking for the nation. And so that's an important thing to bear in mind as well. And so his, you know, his complaints, his prayer really is a prayer for the people. And again, it's hard to know exactly how to divide that prayer up. That whole last section is beginning in verse 40 is kind of the prayer, whether it is the beginning of the prayer itself or, you know, verses 40 and 41, let us test and examine our ways and return to the Lord. Let us lift up our hearts and hands to God in heaven. That's kind of the exhortation to pray, but it's, you know, it's a little bit longer than what we would do. But when we come to the front and say, let us pray, or shall we pray, or let's commune with God, whatever we might say, that's the basic idea. That's kind of the introduction of the prayer in verses 40 and 41. And then there is the prayer itself. And maybe one way of looking at it, and the way that I've got it kind of broken down has some breaks across the triplets of letters as well. So this is definitely not a definitive thing, but this is the way that I've got it in my notes, and you're welcome to disagree completely if you like. Is that the prayer itself is broken down into four basic parts, where you have first the complaint, and then be 40 through 54, if I remember what I wrote down. And that really is broken down into two subparts. I won't write it down on the board. The 42 through 45 is something of a complaint against God, that God has allowed these things to happen. And you find that in the Old Testament quite frequently in the laments, that the psalmist will complain against God. So that's nothing terrible or sacrilegious. 46 through 54 are complaints about the enemies and the grief the enemies have caused. That's pretty clearly, I think, all complaint. The second section is the one that might be more surprising, and it's what I would call a thanksgiving section. And a lot of the language here in 55 through 58 is very reminiscent of thanksgiving psalms. If you find some of the thanksgiving psalms in the book of Psalms, the kind of language that you have here is very reminiscent of that. This could extend even beyond that. But I called on your name, O Lord, from the depths of the pit. You have heard my plea. Do not close your ear to my cry for help. You came near when I called you. You said, do not fear. You have taken up my cause, O Lord. You have redeemed my life. You've seen the wrong done to me, O Lord, judge my cause. You have seen all the vengeance, all their vengeance, all their plots against me. You've heard their taunts, all their plots against me. The lips and thoughts of my assailants are against me all day long. Behold, they're sitting and they're rising. I am the object of their taunts. And so maybe a good way of putting this is something of a transition section where he talks about specifically the actions of his enemies, and that'd be 59 through 63. This is still something in the context of the thanksgiving. God has seen and heard and responded in 55 through 57, and the context of that is the actions of the enemies, verses 59 through 63. But what that's going to kind of lead to is this imprecation, which is not a word we use a whole lot. You hear about the imprecatory psalms sometimes, or the psalms of cursing, and that would be verses 64 through 66, where he calls on God to repay them according to the work of their hands, in verse 64, giving them dullness of heart. Your curse will be on them. You will pursue them in anger and destroy them from under your heavens, O Lord. And so it's a call for the vindication of God's righteousness, putting matters in the hands of God, not taking personal vengeance, but giving it over to God to deal with their wickedness. And so that's the way I think, again, it's not ideal, but that may be one way of looking at the prayer here at the end. And again, as we've said before, I'll mention again, each of these chapters, at least so far, ends with this prayer, which is kind of a significant point, that as bad as things get, they are constantly turning back to God and appealing to Him for some kind of salvation, for some kind of help. All right, any last comments about chapter 3? We didn't get to talk about as many of the details as I would have liked, but Jeremy? Yes.
It would be kind of a theme throughout that the prayers are blocked, and verse 44, mm-hmm. Wrap yourself in the clouds and no prayer can pass through, and then it shifts in that last Thanksgiving section. It says, you've taken up my cause, you've seen the wrongs, the damage is done, and you will repay. So it's almost like a kind of acting out of, you know, the first.
Yeah, a couple things on that, and then I'll stop. First of all, that very well matches the book of Jeremiah in the historical record, where God tells them to stop praying, and God tells Jeremiah to stop praying for them. So the verses in Lamentations 3 that talk about prayers not getting through to God anymore very well matches what's going on with Jeremiah in this historical context. The other thing that I wasn't planning on talking about at all is there are some scholars that argue about the verbal form in the prayer itself and argue that instead of it being a past tense, you have heard my prayer, it's an appeal. We'd say imperative, but that kind of has tell God what to do, but it's more of hear my prayer, that he's in the depths and calling out to God. And it's, you know, I don't have the expertise to engage in that discussion, but there are at least two different ways of reading those, whether it's you have heard my prayer or God, please hear my prayer. Either way, it reflects this idea of, you know, the hope and the goodness of God shifting his focus. So I think it works either way, but that's perhaps something else to think about in the context of that prayer. All right. Thank you for your attention and comments. We'll look at chapter 4 on Wednesday. I should say thanks again for participating in the class in this way, where I'm having you do things differently than normal and participate in a different kind of way. So thank you.